From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Gay Talese, one of the writers who created the style that became known as New Journalism. His new book, his first in more than a decade, is about his Italian-American family history. Also on this Valentine's Day, True Love Confessions, we talk with trash culture maven Michael Barson about his new collection of covers from romance comics of the 40s and 50s. Commentator Maureen Corrigan reads the personal ads by people looking for love in an academic journal. And rock critic Ken Tucker checks out some Scottish bands trying to make it in the U.S. One of them will perform tomorrow night on Saturday Night Live. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The two main warring factions in Somalia agreed today to a United Nations-sponsored ceasefire to end their three-month clan war. Representatives of self-declared President Ali Mahdi Mohamed and his rival, General Mohamed Idid, have been meeting in New York at the invitation of UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali. Under the agreement, a formal ceasefire is to be signed in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, later this month or in early March. The International Red Cross said today that a massive international effort will be needed to save as many as 5 million people who are in danger of famine. The Bush administration responded this afternoon to claims by human rights groups that Haitian refugees forced to return to their country face political persecution. The administration said there's strong reason to doubt the charges. Refugee advocates are trying to block the repatriation of 10,000 Haitians, and they contend that returning refugees are endangered by growing political violence throughout their country. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
The Bush administration told the Supreme Court today the claims that Haitian refugees faced political reprisals if returned home were unreliable and outright false. The administration also denied charges by human rights groups that it had suppressed evidence of Haitian refugees suffering political persecution. Amnesty International, one of several groups opposing the repatriation of the refugees, called Haiti a killing field. Amnesty said that political violence has become so widespread that it is not only too dangerous for refugees to return, but also risky for human rights workers to probe cases of alleged persecution. Meanwhile, 79 refugees fleeing Haiti were picked up today by the U.S. Coast Guard. More than 16,000 have fled since Haiti's military deposed President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in September. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
The civil war continues in Cambodia despite a peace agreement between the government and Khmer Rouge guerrillas. The BBC's Alexander Thompson reports from Phnom Penh that fighting has broken out in the country's richest agricultural region.
Diplomats in Phnom Penh confirm that skirmishes are taking place in the area, but informed sources speaking to the BBC in central Cambodia say the fighting has been at company and at times even at battalion level. A Cambodian battalion numbers between 300 to 400 men. UN officials say there are reports that the Vietnamese are assisting Cambodian government troops, but no evidence has been produced to confirm this. The fighting is continuing despite the presence of a UN military liaison team in Siem Reap, which is trying to monitor the current ceasefire, and despite a recent visit to Phnom Penh by Mr. Chan Chi-chien, the foreign minister of China, which is the principal backer of the Khmer Rouge.
Alexander Thompson in Phnom Penh. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 0.7% today to close at 3,245. This is NPR. Violations of the UN-sponsored ceasefire continued today in Croatia, despite the announcement that the UN Secretary General has recommended deployment of as many as 13,000 peacekeeping troops. At least 4 people were killed today in mortar attacks in eastern Croatia, and Croats claim to have repelled a Serbian infantry attack. Some Croatian officials reacted coldly to the UN peace plan because they regard the deployment of UN troops as a violation of their sovereignty. Germany, which has supported Croatia's bid for independence, applied heavy pressure to get Croatia to accept the peace plan. American speed skater Bonnie Blair has won her second gold medal at the 16th Winter Olympic Games. Today, Blair won the 1,000-meter event by a mere 0.02 of a second over China's Ye Chao Bo. NPR's Tom Goldman reports from Albertville, France.
The winning time of 1 minute 21.90 seconds is 4 seconds slower than the world record. Blair admitted afterwards that today wasn't one of her best 1,000 meters, but it was enough for her to win her fourth medal in Olympic competition. She also won a gold and bronze in 1988. Blair now is tied with speed skater Diane Hollum for the most medals won by an American woman.
That's definitely, I guess, a nice honor to have. I'm proud of that, and I guess I'm glad that I was able to help bring some more gold medals back to the United States.
For silver medalist Ye Chao Bo, today's race was a frustrating repeat of Monday's 500 meter, where she also finished second to Blair. Germany's Monique Garbrecht won today's bronze medal. At the Albertville Olympics, I'm Tom Goldman.
A Milwaukee jury has begun deliberations in the sanity trial of serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer. Dahmer has pleaded guilty but insane in the killings of 15 men and boys. His defense argued that Dahmer's acts of murder, necrophilia, and cannibalism could only have been the acts of a sick man. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Gay Talese was one of the first writers to practice what became known as the New Journalism. He applied the dramatic structure of fiction to carefully researched magazine stories about real people. In the 60s, he was one of the star writers at Esquire magazine. He expanded on his magazine style to write nonfiction books, several of which became bestsellers. The Kingdom and the Power was about the New York Times, Honor Thy Father about a New York mafia family, and Thy Neighbor's Wife about the sexual revolution. Talese himself became a character in Thy Neighbor's Wife, engaging in sexual relations with some of the women he interviewed, which made him and his book the subject of criticism, even mockery. After that book was published in 1980, he began a new book on his own Italian-American family history. It's just been published. It's called Unto the Sons. Talese remembers the moment when he decided to look at his own life and family as material for his next book.
Reaching the age of 50 for me back in 1981 was a time where I gave pause. I, in fact, was on an airplane 3 days before my 50th birthday, a small plane that was about to crash. The pilot and the co-pilot came back. This was between Denver and Santa Fe, and there were 9 of us on the plane, small commuter flight. And the pilot said, or the co-pilot said, gentlemen, please, we're going to crash. We have run out of our left landing gears. It doesn't go down, and we want you to remove from your pocket any hard object, such as a fountain pen, release your ties, and assume this position when I give it to you later. It was a crouch position. I walked around the cabin and thought, this is the end, but I won't be 50. I'm 49, 5 or 6 days from being 50. At that time, my book, Thy Neighbor's Wife, was number one on the bestseller list. I'd had behind me some accomplished work that had been recognized, and I dreaded the future in the sense of being old and not being able to be the vigorous reporter that I thought I had been up to that point. I wrote a note to my wife and my 2 daughters. I had 20 minutes, I was told, before the plane would circle back to Denver. These 15 or 20 minutes that I had were time to ponder where I had been. And I thought, it's all over for me. And yet there was, and this is maybe bizarre to you, but within myself, as a journalist, I was thinking of news events. This shows you how detached I was from whatever self I was recognizing at that time. I thought, I am going to go down before 50, and I'm going to go down with a pretty good record in terms of achievement, which is another way of saying news value. I was judging myself in terms, and the only terms I've been reared to evaluate as a journalist, news value. Short of it is, the plane did crash, and the short of it is, I'm here today.
The plane did crash?
No, it did. It crash-landed, but we weren't killed, clearly, or here I wouldn't be among your honored guests this morning.
So what did this, plane crash tell you about your family?
It told me that I don't know what it is that I am, except a journalist. And when I got out of that plane, I had not a clear idea what I was going to do next. It wasn't too much pondering beyond that point that I decided I want to do a personal story so that I can leave some record of what I really am apart from what I do.
Your previous book, Thy Neighbor's Wife, was about the sexual revolution, and you even managed a massage parlor during part of it, and you yourself were one of the characters in the book. So it seems like you've gone in a way from one extreme to another in your last 2 books, you know, from the sexual revolution to the old country. Yeah, which is where you went for Unto the Suns, back to Italy, back to the place your father was born.
My life, while I've described it as being a life concentrating on the actions of other people, nevertheless, in everything I've written, there have been my fingerprints. There's a sense of myself that I kept secret from the reader, but it's clearly there in the shadows of whatever it is that I wrote. Example, Thy Neighbor's Wife goes back to my hometown and to my boyhood. I was an altar boy, reared in a very strict Irish Catholic parish in a large Protestant community. And as an altar boy, nuns and priests had control of my life and control of my sense of what was sinful and not sinful. And I was reared in a strong attitude of sin involving sexual affairs. Sexual affairs might be in the sense of books that were erotic, films that were erotic, thoughts that were erotic. Anything of that was supposed to be eradicated from our consciousness. So we grew up, myself and those classmates in that parochial school, grew up with a sense of severity with regard to what was obscene. And not surprisingly, being the curious person that I became as a journalist, I would be interested in who is obscene in America and why were they obscene and what made them so different from people who were not obscene. The idea of pursuing sin, the idea of living with sinners and writing about sin, such as it was defined, I should say, in my Catholic parish back in my boyhood.
How did you change as a person from when you were writing Thy Neighbor's Wife, writing about the sexual revolution, to when you were writing Unto the Sons, writing about your family history? I mean, they're two such different subjects. Did you stop the experimentation that you were doing during the sexual revolution when you started writing about your family history? Did you change worlds yourself?
No, I see myself as rather consistently pursuing the same approach to research no matter what it is that I'm doing. There are books that I wrote that you haven't heard of because they're so obscure. One is a book on bridge building, and there was a book about men who go on high places and do deal with wired steel and put together a grand structure such as the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, which separates Brooklyn from Staten Island. Now, when I did that book, I was up there with the cable builders and the riveting gangs, and I lived with the Indians who were also active on this. And I live my subjects. I am like an actor that takes a role and totally loses myself. So it is also true. I lived the New York Times years, and I wrote about it from the inside my head, inside my very sense of all my values are connected to what it is that I am writing about. When I dealt with the mafia, I hung out with these gangsters. I was not writing from the point of view of the Justice Department or from the police department. I was involved with, living with, consorting with known criminals, reveling in the fact that I was part of the underworld. And when I wrote about Thy Neighbor's Wife, yes, indeed, I did get involved. I went to nudist camps. I managed massage parlors, as you said. I wanted to know, indeed, to travel with, to consort with known sinners, people that were convicted of all kinds of crimes of obscenity and pornography. I'm interested in the dark world of human life. I wanted to know about the side streets of this society. And when I dealt with the current book, Unto the Sons, again, I'm back into the depth of my adolescence and all the turmoil that was part of it and the conflict and the difficulty of recognizing myself as an American. So I'm always digging as deep as I can possibly go, and there's nothing that I find revolting about what it is that I want to know, because I'm finally and totally interested in expanding knowledge in those areas that I believe there are a lot of blank spaces. And my own life is a report of these blank spaces. So I just got into them and delved into them and got lost in them. And I emerge at a certain period in time when I start to write. That's about my story, my life.
Let me have you read a short passage from your new book, Unto the Sons. And your father is a tailor, or was a tailor. You know, I don't know.
Is it? My father, who's 87 years old and still does certain amount of sewing each day, but was a tailor all his life, and I have other relatives who are tailors. I come from a family of more tailors than anything else.
My grandfather was a tailor.
Was he from Europe?
Yep, sure was. Uh-huh. Yeah, Eastern Europe.
Right.
Yeah. So let me have you read this passage.
It was my destiny to become the dutiful son of an exacting tailor who presumed to possess the precise measurement of my body and soul. And it was my unavoidable birthright to wear the custom clothes that reflected his taste, advertised his trade, and reaffirmed his talent with the needle and thread. I became my father's miniature mannequin soon after I learned to walk, and during winter I was draped in sturdy worsted coats and jackets with square shoulders, and hand-stitching on the edges of my lapels. And on my head was a feathered felt fedora, slanted at an angle favored by my father, that was occasionally knocked off by the rowdy students with whom I rode the school bus to parochial school.
Did your clothes define the activities that you could and couldn't get involved in as a kid?
To a degree, that's true. Clothes to me, I was a prisoner of clothes, to tell you the truth, in the beginning. My father dressed me, as I said, like a miniature mannequin, something that would... I was a walking signboard, in a sense, for his shop, for his skill. The young men and young women that I went to parochial school and later to high school with, of course, dressed in the casual style of young people. And I was yearning to be, I yearned to be like them. All of us as adolescents would like to be part of a group and be accepted by a group. And I was isolated from the group.
It seems in a way you probably never rebelled against the suits that you had to wear when you were young, because you're still famous for wearing very fine, customized suits.
It became so much a part of me that if I rebelled, and I think I did in other ways, but in terms of tailoring, I guess I didn't. I guess I do not. I never rebelled in that way. But on the other hand, I do think that in my choice of what to write about and how I've done it, how I've done my research, I know that I was a source of embarrassment to my father and mother in much of what I've chosen to write about. So in that sense, you might say there's a rebel in my rather conformist clothing.
You know, I found myself wondering if fancy suits were a new journalism thing, you know, with Tom Wolfe and his fine white suits and you and your tailored suits.
Well, Tom... and I admire him very, very much, and we're personal friends as well. He started something when he called certain people new journalists back in the early 1970s. And he, of course, he included me. Not of course, he did. He, in fact, featured me. And I took this as not a left-handed compliment, but I took it with some misgiving because I did not want to be identified by him or anyone else as part of a group of people because as my whole life, I said, I've had a sense of comfort in being isolated. But more important, many of these so-called new journalists were people that didn't take a lot of time. They were very opinionated writers who did not do a great deal of research. And I became affiliated with the group of people who were into, shortcutting their work. And that's not such a flattering definition as I see it.
Well, how would you define the kind of style you've developed over the years?
I was, as a young man, into escapism through literature as well as fantasy. I was a reader of short stories. I loved fiction writing. What made fiction writing so special to me was that it dealt with privacy. And yet the course that I took in terms of identity and craft and career was nonfiction writing. It started as a journalist. And we journalists are more often than not dealing with public people, famous people, newsworthy people.
Well, sure, you're doing people like Frank Sinatra and Joe
Yeah,
Maggio.
And we all do. Whereas the fiction writers, the Mary Gordons and the Philip Roths, etc., are really writing about interpersonal relationships, writing about their parents, writing about their childhood, they're writing about their girlfriends, their boyfriend. And I wanted to write about that, too.
What was your first real breakthrough in developing the style that you wanted?
Once I had an assignment to cover Joe Louis, he, the great heavyweight champion from the 1940s, 50s. And I was flying with him from New York to Los Angeles. He lived then in Los Angeles. And I just after we left the baggage claim, carrying our suitcases, I was going to spend a few days interviewing him out there. His wife came running up the ramp and greeted him and put her arms around him and then realized as she kissed him that he hadn't shaved that morning. And as he looked tired, and she said, "Joe, you look like you've been out all night." And he said, "Yep, sweetie, I had a long evening last night." And she said something to the effect, "Well, when you're here, you go to bed early, and we have a pretty dull life. And when you go out there to New York, you suddenly get young again." And there was this dialogue between husband and wife, the old champ and his third wife. And I listened to it. And then he finally introduced me. And when I wrote the piece later on, this is for Esquire, I sort of opened with that scene of an old champ meeting his wife in an airport and his being young again in New York. And now he's back with marital life, which to the both of them seemed, at least to her, seemed quite routine. I mean, that's when I wrote it, and it appeared. And about 7 or 8 years later, Tom Wolfe, in writing this anthology, The New Journalism, said that's what turned him on to new journalism. Now, I didn't myself think of it. That's the way Irwin Shaw would have written that. You know, girls in their summer dresses, sailor off the Bremen. I mean, the way these wonderful writers with a poetic soul would deal with human involvement with one another, the relationships of men and women. This is something that I, as a boy, and never did it cease to fascinate me, as worthy of being written about, but by nonfiction writers. And I just didn't see why I could not try to do that.
You know, I'm thinking so many Italian Americans in the United States have grown up in Italian American communities, and there really is a sense of a culture that you're part of, whereas you grew up in a community that was largely Irish.
And Protestant, yeah.
Yeah, so you didn't have that...
Protection, the insularity of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's why I became a writer. Maybe that's why I was more than curious about who I was, because there wasn't much that I could look around. I mean, I couldn't look around and see other people with similar lives and say, okay, we're part of this group. I was groupless.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I very much enjoyed it, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
Gay Talese, his new book is Unto the Suns. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new records after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Tomorrow night, Saturday Night Live's musical guest will be the rock band Teenage Fan Club. This group, along with Primal Scream, are Scotland's latest contributions to the music scene. Both bands are on tour in the U.S. and have new albums out. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
What you do to me?
Until now, Scotland's chief contributions to rock and roll were Sheena Easton, the bland pop sex symbol, and the Bay City Rollers, a charming 70s teeny bopper act that wore tartan kilts and never became quite as popular as, say, the Monkees. A few years ago, another Scottish act, the Jesus and Mary Chain, caused a stir throughout Europe by making Feedback Drone sound emotional and urgent, but over here, only college students paid much attention. Now a couple of new acts from Glasgow are doing their best to crack the American market. That's Primal Scream, whose album Screamadelica has yielded that tune, Loaded. It's already been a substantial dance club hit in America and throughout the world. The trouble is, Primal Scream gives new poignancy to the term one-hit wonder. The band's follow-up single, Come Together, is more or less the exact same song, this time with banal lyrics attached.
Kiss me. Won't you kiss me? Won't you kiss me? Lift me right out of this world. Trap me. Won't you trap.
Where Primal Scream is mildly catchy, Teenage Fan Club is exceptionally catchy. On their new second album called Bandwagon-esque, it becomes immediately clear that this Scottish quartet has studied its Beatle records closely. They prefer the Fab Four's White Album period, as well as admiring the work of Buffalo Springfield, The Byrds, and The Beach Boys. They are, as it were, solid B students.
Mother, and she's got me on the run.
When it comes to originality, though, Teenage Fan Club doesn't have it. The more assiduous rock fans among you will also recognize yet another profound influence on these young fellows, Big Star, an American rock band led in the 70s by Alex Chilton. Teenage Fan Club has mastered all these bands' intentionally sour harmonies, their jangling guitars, and their deadpan, simple-minded lyrics. The result is music at once irresistible and trite. Here is music that will never make people think of Scotland as a hotbed of musical revolution, but certainly a welcome home for imaginative slavishness.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Bandwagonesque by Teenage Fan Club and Screamadelica by Primal Scream. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and here's Teenage Fan Club with I Don't Know.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up for Valentine's Day, love lessons and diary secrets, as revealed by the romance comics of the 40s and 50s. We talk with Michael Barson, who's brought pages from these comics together in a new book. Also, commentator and college professor Maureen Carrigan examines the lengths to which her colleagues will go to find a little romance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The two main factions in the bloody Somalian civil war have agreed to lay down their arms. The two sides have been holding talks at the United Nations this week. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
UN officials say the two sides will sign separate letters tonight agreeing to an immediate cessation of hostilities in their 13-month-old civil war. A formal ceasefire will then be signed in the capital of Mogadishu sometime before the end of the month. It will be followed by talks aimed at resolving the group's differences. Somalia has been embroiled in a bloody power struggle among different members of the same clan since last January. Nearly 20,000 people have been killed or wounded since November alone. Since taking office last month, UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has made ending the war a priority. UN officials say there are still differences among the groups about how the ceasefire will be carried out, differences they're now attempting to resolve. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Fundamentalist leaders in Algeria called off a government protest march today after gunfire erupted. Marchers ran and ducked for cover. Muslim fundamentalist leaders had planned the protest in defiance of a government ban. Army commando units and police swept through neighborhoods looking for gunmen who had fired on security forces at noon during the march. At least one person was injured. Muslim clergy then urged their congregations to disperse rather than continue to march. In Milwaukee, a jury has begun deliberating the sanity trial of Jeffrey Dahmer. The jurors will decide if Dahmer was sane or not when he killed 15 young men and boys. From member station WUWM, Sherry Hemsott reports.
The defense argued Dahmer is a man obsessed with his fantasy to have sex with the dead. Gerald Boyle said Dahmer could not control his actions and compared his behavior to an alcoholic.
He was the alcoholic with the shakes sitting at the table with the bottle in front of him. Who takes the drink? It's too late to ask that guy, hey, pal, come on, don't take that drink. It's all, you got control.
The prosecution argued Dahmer carefully orchestrated each murder from crushing sleeping pills to stalking victims all night at gay bars. If the jury finds Dahmer was in control and therefore sane, he'd face life in prison. Otherwise, he'd likely be sent to a mental institution until he was cured and then be transferred to prison. For National Public Radio, I'm Sherry Hemsott in Milwaukee.
The Labor Department today said prices at the wholesale level fell 0.3% last month. That's the biggest drop in 10 months. But at the same time, industrial production skidded, falling 0.9% in January. The steep drop in industrial output was heavily influenced by cutbacks in auto production, but it was widespread, with a number of manufacturing industries reporting lower output. On Wall Street, stocks fell a fraction of a point to close at 3245.97. This is NPR. The Natural Resources Defense Council is telling American consumers that aerosol cans are not the biggest threat to the ozone. Their car air conditioners are. The average car air conditioner has about 2.5 pounds of chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs. That's about five times as much as a second villain, the refrigerator, which contains 6 to 8 ounces. The council says nearly 20% of all CFCs come from car air conditioners in the United States. Their recommendation? Have your car air conditioner and your refrigerator serviced regularly, and then find companies that recycle them when you're finished with them. Also, try turning your AC off. President Bush has a full weekend of campaigning ahead. The president becomes a candidate again for 2 event-filled days in New Hampshire to counter a protest vote in Tuesday's primary for Republican challenger Patrick Buchanan. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Manchester.
Although there are no hotel rooms left in New Hampshire to accommodate the president's entire entourage, the Bush campaign goes into high gear this weekend to make sure that Buchanan doesn't do well in the polls on Tuesday. The president's trip includes routine pancake breakfasts, handshaking at the mall, and two Ask George Bush sessions with the voters. The campaign hopes that the president's presence in New Hampshire, coupled with visits by surrogates like First Lady Barbara Bush and television ads that are running at a rate of 27 times a day, will be enough to head off the Buchanan protest vote. Republican strategists say it's unlikely the campaign will resort to negative ads in the final stretch, although they'll be ready. The president aims to beat Buchanan by a 2-to-1 margin in Tuesday's primary. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Manchester.
There was some sunshine today in Southern California, but the National Weather Service says an upcoming weekend storm could pour more rain on the region. Between 1 and 2 inches are expected. A foot of rain has already fallen on the region. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In celebration of Valentine's Day, we thought we'd read an old love comic.
And now, another edition of Young Romance.
Mary, I've just left Cliff. He's not showing up for the wedding. As best man, I really don't know what to say.
Say you'll marry me, Johnny. I know you've always loved me.
As your pastor, I must say, don't act in haste, my child. The young man may love you, but do you love him? This step could lead to heartbreak for you both.
In the late 40s and 50s, the comic book houses were churning out stories of true love, first romance, intimate secrets, and shocking betrayal. The covers from many of these comics are collected in the new book Boy Loves Girl, Girl Loves Boy. Each cover is reprinted on a tear-and-send postcard. My guest is the editor, Michael Barson, who's also put together postcard collections of ad posters from juvenile delinquent movies and rock and roll films. And now another page of comic book love.
Pictorial romances. In this issue, I was the other woman.
Have a good time on your trip, Mary. Don't worry about anything.
I will, dear. Keep an eye on him, Jean. You're the only woman I trust with my husband.
You insipid little fool. By the time you get back, you won't have a husband.
Michael Barson, what do you love about these romance comics?
Well, being a boy...
Yes, I thought you'd mention that.
And having been a boy, I have to admit I didn't participate at the time so much in these, but now that I'm a grown-up, I appreciate how much they taught everyone who was reading them, which was, I believe, mostly females, about the rules of love and the rules which now, 40 or 45 years later, seem to have changed so much. I guess it's the way they pass on a message about the culture of the time. At least I assume that what they're telling us was partly true.
Well, being a girl, I used to read romance comics when I was in summer camp, and we'd all buy them and swap. So before I ever had a real romance, I'd learn about important questions like, is it better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all? So, I mean, I think I did get a sense of the rules of love from these, like you were saying.
Yeah, I'm still trying to answer that question. I'm not sure.
Right. But no, I mean, I really thought that these were, that when I got old enough, that these were the questions that I'd have to struggle through.
Well, the frightening thing is that, you know, you look at these and they seem so silly, but the scary thing is that about half of them probably have actually happened in my life and your life, and that's even scarier because they are absurd, but I guess sometimes our love lives are absurd too.
Michael, what did you used to think of girls who read these comics?
Well, I envied them because I felt that they were privy to information that I was excluded from. And I still think that this is possibly why that old saw about girls getting an earlier start than boys and knowing what to do and being more advanced and all that. They must have learned it from these things while we had to read the sporting news and, you know, the Fantastic Four or things like that, which don't prepare you for life.
Was there a comic that got you interested in romance comics now as an adult and as somebody who is basically an archaeologist of trash culture?
I can't say there's a particular one, although I will tell you that the original title for Boy Loves Girl, Girl Loves Boy was Throbbing Love, which was the title of one of the comics I came across. And I thought that that perfectly expressed the agony and the passion that we all go through. But my publishers, in a moment of sanity, decided that some people might get the wrong idea. So it was not Throbbing Love. But they did have those titles. Sometimes Flaming Love was another one that I came across. And they probably didn't deliver any of these ultra-exciting moments. But still, the idea was to get you to buy them on the newsstand, and I'm sure people did.
Well, speaking of what they delivered and what they didn't, how did the comic book code relate to romance comics? What did it have to say about what you could draw, what you could illustrate or talk about?
Well, as a matter of fact, almost all of the ones I selected are from before the Comics Code, simply because the Comics Code more or less ruined this genre. I think it was February of 1955, the Comics Code went into effect, and it definitely killed all of the horror comic book and science fiction comic book genres. This one kept going for another 15 or so years into the early 70s, but it really vitiated it. It took away all of the elements that made these so much fun, which was somebody being stuck in a car with a guy who pretended he was out of gas, and someone having their reputation ruined, and, you know, because it was ruined, having to descend into a life of shame and degradation. They were sanitized after that Comics Code period, and you still had situations like the peer pressure ones and betraying your friend to steal the guy away, but they weren't handled with that candor and that little bit of sleaziness even that made these so appealing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Barson, and he's been, over the past few years, putting together collections of movie posters from trash films and juvenile delinquent films of the 50s and rock and roll movie posters. And his new collection is postcards that are the covers of romance comics from the 1940s and 50s. And it's called Boy Loves Girl, Girl Loves Boy. And it's just been published. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Barson, and his new book is a collection of covers from romance magazines. It's called Boy Loves Girl, Girl Loves Boy. Well, in terms of the illustrations, I think there isn't a woman or a teenage girl in these who doesn't have what we like to call an ample bosom.
Well, I just assume that in the 50s, that's how they made women, Terry. I mean, that's...
Oh, I really used to think that. I used to think that somehow, like, bosom shrank. In the early 60s, you know, I grew up watching all this stuff in the 50s when everybody, all the women in the movies wore bullet bras, which I, of course, thought were the real thing.
Well, of course, I didn't know any better. If you didn't, how would I know? But
really?
I was always terrified by those older high school girls that I saw that, you know, had these things that looked like they would sort of hurt you if you pressed up against them and in an embrace. Of course, I never had the chance anyway, so it was a moot point. But it's true.
There's a couple of romance comics in your collection that have social themes. And I've got one here. It's from Romantic Marriage. And the headline is, the title is White Collar Wife, My Own Worst Enemy. Torn between marriage and career. And in this one, a working woman has just come home at night and her husband's fast asleep in his red and white striped pajamas. And she's thinking, her thought bubble reads, asleep again. I know this job keeps me out pretty late, but the least he could do is wait up for me. Maybe mother was right. How can a marriage survive without any companionship?
Well, I must confess, this probably is my favorite in the entire book, and I picked it because it's the one that I think has to speak most directly to 1992. More so now than back then. This was a 1954 comic book, but certainly today that situation, although it's pretty funny when you see it depicted and with that thought balloon that you just read, but it also is a real situation with two career couples. I don't know how he got to sack out so early while she was out. Maybe he just is a post office worker who gets home at 5 every night and she's in the office till 11. I like speculating on what these situations, where they go after the story ends, too. There's a lot of food for thought there. But there are several here that you could make a case that they actually have some relevance. The one for romantic marriage, number 2, which is the other issue of romantic marriage I have in this book, about mother's boy and the man who lets his mother get in between him and his new bride because the mother is jealous of the new bride taking him away. You can't tell me that doesn't still happen and probably will continue to happen to certain types of people, who get married and who have possessive mothers.
Are there a lot of comics about single women, independent women on their own?
In this category of love comics?
Yeah. Well, they're all single. None of them
yes,
are married.
Yes, they're all. I mean, that's the point. Once you've become a couple and a permanent couple, which marriage implies at least, you don't need these anymore. These are for and about single women who are trying to learn how to, I guess, not become single women eventually. And these little morality tales and how-to tales, or however you want to look at these, are directed that way. My question to everyone would be, now that there aren't these anymore, what do people do for this information? The only thing like this I can find out there in our culture at the moment is Beverly Hills 90210.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say.
But just think, that show's only 2 years old, so that means that for about 15 years, nobody in America learned anything about love. I guess you can learn from music. I mean, that we know. And you can learn from music and have your emotions worked through vicariously that way. But I'm very curious. I don't see an exact parallel to how there used to be love pulp magazines and then the comic books came in. I don't know what people do to indulge now. Is it Harlequin romances? Or
Those are for older people.
Yes, I would think so.
Yeah.
Those are mostly, mature heroines with mature situations. There's none of this stuff about you're pushing a baby carriage and your old boyfriend sees you, so you pretend that you're just babysitting because you don't want him to know it's your kid. I mean,
there's all the soap operas, all the daytime soaps.
Well, true, and there had been soap operas even before there was television on radio. I don't know. It just seems like there's this publishing black hole of romance that.
Yeah. Where did you find the comics that you used for your book?
Well, really, I found them just where you'd expect to find them, either from two main sources. I would either go to comic book conventions, which, since I live in New York, I went to New York ones, but they're all over the country all the time, and just look in the boxes marked Love Comics, or I would buy them through the mail from comic book dealers. The days where you really could just luck out at a flea market and find a box of 300 of these things for a dime a piece are no more. So, you have to go to the professionals, really, to get these. I also had a good stack of them that I'd been schlepping around with me for year after year as I kept moving along with the rest of my different collections. But I did have to augment it to get the very best examples for this book.
Well, your home must look like a shrine to trash culture.
I like to think so, yes. my wife has remarked on on the trash element. I'm not sure the shrine part of it came through to her, but actually, now that we're out of an apartment and in a three-story house, I have an attic, just like I used to have when I was a lad, and I fill it up any way I want because, you know, it's out of the way, and so I do have all of my posters and movie magazines and comic books and other things that I like to mine for whatever it is I'm working on.
Well, Michael, thanks a lot for being with us, and happy Valentine's Day.
Same to you, Terry.
Michael Barson edited the new book, Boy Loves Girl, Girl Loves Boy. Tear and send postcards from Romance Comic Books.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have from New Hampshire?
Well, Linda Wertheimer, who is up there, reports today on a free clinic that serves western New Hampshire, tries to offer preventive medical care nowadays to many people who aren't used to availing themselves of the services of a free clinic because someone in the family has lost a job and lost medical insurance. We'll hear what those folks think about the primary season. Also, a talk with media watcher Kathleen Jamison of the Annenberg School of Communications about what use polls serve and how polls are being misused in covering elections. We'll also hear about the issue of education in this year's presidential primary season.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's Valentine's Day, and as usual, we're inundated with stories about strange but true romances. New York Magazine has a feature on unlikely New Yorkers who met cute, you know, the kind of goofy, serendipitous meeting that usually happens in movies. And Entertainment Weekly has a cover story on TV's most famous odd couples, like Morticia and Gomez Adams, and Mary Richards and Lou Grant. Commentator Maureen Corrigan agrees those couplings are odd, but says the courting rituals of academics are even more bizarre.
You'd think that people who've spent their lives studying the great masterpieces of romantic love, the sonnets of Shakespeare and Petrarch, the paintings of Titian, and the music of Mozart, you'd think that these people would be fluent in the language of love. But no, when it comes to passion, your average academic is about as eloquent as Flipper. I think one reason why we intellectuals are so tongue-tied when it comes to romance is that the longer you spend analyzing a condition, the more self-conscious you become about actually indulging in it yourself. I once knew of two historians who fell in love and decided to get married. The problem was that their years of research had enlightened them to the fact that marriage was an oppressive cultural institution. They couldn't just tie the knot without announcing their scholarly qualms. So they sent out wedding invitations on which they had superimposed clever anti-marriage quotations by social revolutionaries like Mary Wollstonecraft and Simone de Beauvoir. The whole invitation was so encrusted in irony, it was hard to tell whether these two people were about to get married or join the Symbionese Liberation Army. Lovelorn academics find themselves in a particularly unpleasant pickle on Valentine's Day. Everybody else can turn to simple Moon, Spoon, and June jingles to attract that special someone. But when you've spent years scanning heroic couplets and iambic hexameters, the bard of Hallmark just won't cut it. How to only connect, as E.M. Forster said, Well, this Valentine's Day, Lingua Franca, a cheeky journal of academic life, has offered a solution. It's running a special personals column where randy intellectuals can warble love lyrics in their own tortured J. Alfred Prufrock style. Here's an ad I bet will get a lot of responses. Brilliant, stormy historienne, tall, striking Italianate woman seeks deeply decent, stable, wealthy, stylish leftist. Gramsci, anyone? Can't you just hear Humphrey Bogart quoting Gramsci into Lauren Bacall's ear? The ruling class imposes its will upon the proletariat through cultural hegemony, sweetheart. Ooh, say that again. A divorced white female professor describes herself as warm, witty, and itty-bitty, and coyly asks, "Wanna be teacher's pet?" Teacher's pet, please. Toss out that dog-eared copy of Lolita, Doc. There's a Thoreau scholar who claims to be fluent in Greenspeak, Marxism, and colonial discourse, a married Dickensian publisher who's looking for a woman to share a chinwag, what would little Dorrit say to that, and a post-patriarchal, single white male who seeks a woman willing to decode the cosmic buzz. An ad placed by a gay historian stranded in the upper Midwest is one of the ones that specifies, "No deconstructionists, please." Well, can you blame him? The only thing worse than being stranded in the upper Midwest is being stranded there with a deconstructionist. By the way, don't look for this special Valentine's Day issue of Lingua Franca on your local newsstand just yet. In true academic fashion, the publishers are running about a week late. But no matter. As foreign policy scholars would know, these ads read suspiciously like they're from the NATO school of romantic love. No action, talk only.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Makes you yearn for roses are red, violets are blue, doesn't it? Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Richard Parker. Thanks to Fred Landrell for being with us these past couple of weeks. I'm Terry Gross, and I'm going on vacation. Marty Moskowain will be back to host the show. Talk to you soon.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, violence. We talk with Richard Bausch about his new novel. It's about a man whose life has changed when he survives the armed robbery of a convenience store. That and more coming up on the next Fresh Air.